All right, it's 5:30 on Monday, September 26, 2016. We'll call the Village of Alloway Plan Commission meeting to order. We'll begin with roll call. Wheeler?
Here.
Dart is absent. Kowalczyk Adrians?
Here.
Karnowski is here. Retzloff?
Here.
Knorr?
Here.
Sment?
Here.
Okay. Moving on to item number two, modify or adopt the existing agenda. If anybody has any modifications.
Move to adopt the agenda as presented.
Okay.
Motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Agenda carries. Moving on to item number three, minutes from August 22nd, 2016. They're in your packet if you have any modifications you'd like to make. If there are none, I'll entertain a motion.
Move to adopt.
There's a motion.
Second.
And a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
Retzloff abstains.
Okay. Moving on to item number four, minutes from September 7th, 2016. Also in your packet. The site tour minutes. Doesn't look like there's a lot of conversation.
As a correction, there was a lot of conversation. It was not recorded.
I'll entertain a motion if it looks acceptable.
Move to adopt.
1 second.
James Wheeler abstains.
No abstains.
Hey, how do you want to work that, Tyler? I'm going to have to abstain myself.
Okay.
For lack of the ability to vote on the minutes, do you want to just move them to the next meeting? Can we do that? Could we make a motion to move the minutes to the next meeting for approval?
Sure. I mean, we should not take action on it.
Okay. Given that nobody can vote on them, do you need a motion to move to the next agenda, or is the lack of people able to vote enough?
I think we just move forward with the lack of motion.
Okay.
I guess you do it either way.
The minutes from September 7, 2016 will be on the next Plan Commission meeting agenda for approval. Moving on to item number five, announcements from anybody on the Plan Commission or staff.
Just a reminder, this will probably be the first or the last one for this year, but we have 2 weeks left in our farmer's market. It goes through October 6th, Thursday evening, 3:30 to 6:30.
How was Lorelei's festival with the bridge being out? Did you hear anything? Good numbers? Or?
I heard good numbers.
Good.
Yeah, well, I don't know what that really meant, but I was unable to go. So.
Sure. Have you heard any other impacts from local businesses on the bridge?
A discussion was held at the last Alloway Business Association meeting about forming a committee to have some sort of a celebration once the bridge is officially open again. So there's going to be some groundwork being done to get that organized. And Peggy Schrader is very interested in helping to do that, so I'll follow up with her probably tomorrow. I was gone all last week, so.
Okay.
But, yeah, we'll look forward to making sure the Plan Commission is well aware of what's going on.
Great.
When is our reopening?
The email I received while I was gone indicated that they don't have a firm date yet.
Okay.
But it looks like towards the end of October.
Have there been delays or problems with them?
I don't know how many work days they've missed due to weather.
Okay. Any other announcements? We'll move on to item number 6, public appearances. If anybody from the audience wants to mention anything to the Plan Commission, please step up to the podium. State your name and address.
Jim O'Rourke, 2339 Oakwood Avenue. I'm glad that Rebecca's going to be here to talk about grading and zoning, because she'd be an expert on zoning. My concern that I've had for the past several years, and I've made it known to the board, is that I'm concerned about the excessive use of planned district developments. I believe that they've been used abusively to circumvent the zoning code, and that any planned district developments that are put in should comply with the underlying zoning. And the most recent one that has gotten the neighborhood up in arms was the one on Martha Street, which is at on Webster and St. Matthews, where two single-family lots are planned to be turned into two apartment buildings with 6 units each. And I don't believe that that's allowed to be done because the underlying zoning is for single-family, not high-density. That using the PDD circumvents the zoning code, and that if that were to be approved, that in fact becomes de facto zoning, which is illegal in Wisconsin. So de facto zoning is not allowed in Wisconsin, and so those are the three arguments against putting apartments on that particular site. There were 5 other projects that were PDDs. The current Old Chapel Hill is an apartment complex going on to a site that is owned commercial. Again, that's de facto rezoning to apartments, so that shouldn't have been done. That should have been rezoned. So those are some of the questions that I'm going to have, and hopefully it can be just addressed briefly tonight, and then somebody can look into it a little bit deeper in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Any other members of the public want to speak? Okay. Moving on to item number 7, discussion of zoning code project. Presentation from Rebecca Roberts, Center from Land Use Education.
You guys can call me Becky. I work at UW-Stevens Point in the Center for Land Use Education, and that's part of the statewide extension system. So I do a lot of presentations around the state. A lot of them are much larger presentations where I will do training for plan commissioners and zoning boards and other local government officials. But I was asked to come talk, I think, strictly about what's the difference between a traditional or Euclidean type zone, zoning ordinance versus a form-based code. And so that's how I'm going to start. But I understand that you're just thinking about your zoning code in general, how it works, what are some adjustments you can make to it, possibly updating it. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that as well. So for those of you who didn't hear, I am a bit familiar with the area. I grew up in Green Bay, spent a lot of time playing in your soccer fields, and I do get back off of that. So I'm somewhat familiar, but certainly not the expert on your zoning code or your community. So feel free to ask questions as we go and interject your knowledge as well. So I promise not to spend a lot of time on history, but zoning in the United States is officially 100 years old. And so it's an evolving creature. That's a tool that local governments use. It's not the end-all be-all. It's not perfect. There's a lot of issues with zoning. And so I think communities are constantly tweaking it, updating their zoning codes to make it work for them. So I just want to take you a little bit historically through some of these things. So 1916, New York was the first community in the United States to adopt an official zoning ordinance, as most communities use it today. They were primarily concerned with large, tall buildings that were blocking out uses next to them. They had a lot of industrial uses next to residential uses, and so they had the first use-based zoning system. So if you think of that context versus the Village of Alloway, we've come a long way, and we've really adapted this tool over time. many other big cities jumped in, like Milwaukee. Early in the 1920s, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld zoning. 1926, the Department of Commerce actually created the Standard State Zoning Enabling Act. And after that, a lot of communities jumped on board in terms of creating zoning ordinances. There are models available. Wisconsin was a leader in rural zoning. We were also a leader in shoreland and floodplain zoning. And then I think in the 1960s and beyond, there were a lot of innovations in. Now many communities, not just those very urban ones, were using it. And so there were a lot of innovations. People looking for more flexibility within new zoning codes. We saw an increase in discretionary approvals. That 1926 Standard Act set the table with permitted uses, conditional uses, variances, rezones. We're seeing a lot of other things, like performance standards, especially environmental performance standards, planned development districts. As we got into the 80s, we're seeing a lot more master planning, greenfield development. You're starting to hear terms like new urbanism, the return to traditional neighborhood development, and terms like transit. And those types of things really set the stage for today, where we're hearing about form-based codes. So in Wisconsin, there was a large turning point in 1999 when the legislature adopted the comprehensive planning law. And if we look back to the 20s, only a couple years after the Standard State Zoning Enabling Act, there was a Planning Enabling Act. The idea was that planning and the plan should come before zoning, but because of the order in which these acts were put out, a lot of people jumped onto zoning, and in Wisconsin in particular, plans kind of followed behind much, much later. And so in this 1999 Comprehensive Planning Law, there was this requirement that there be consistency between the plans. Plan for your community first, and then if you're going to make a rezoning decision, if you're going to make changes to your zoning ordinance, they need to be consistent with this future-oriented comprehensive plan. And then more recently, we're seeing things like the SMART code, which is a type of form-based code. This is a model code, but it's an open-ended one. You can take it, you can calibrate, you can use it for your local community. So that's as much as I'm going to say about history. But that brings us to Euclidean zoning, or traditional zoning, as most communities use it. And that really operates on two scales. So across the landscape, most communities are still concerned with uses, dividing compatible and incompatible uses. And they do that through districts and the zoning map. Then at the site scale, they're concerned with what uses are allowed in each district, what are the dimensional standards, how high can we go, what kind of setbacks do we need, kind of parking requirements are there, and so forth. So, again, you'll see the traditional zoning map. Visually, that's what a lot of people think of with zoning. And then there's the text of the ordinance. This one happens to show a use table that shows the different dimensional requirements associated with a residential district. And so they might say, all right, I pressed the wrong button. Sorry about that. There we go. So again, you can just see along the left side. You have similar requirements in your zoning code, talking a lot with setbacks, etc. Okay, and then for each zoning district, there's typically a list of allowed uses. So there's going to be permitted uses. These are things that are allowed by right. It's listed for the district, and you meet the standards. It should be granted. That's something that the zoning administrator will look at. Then there's typically a set of conditional uses or special exceptions. Most communities use those terms interchangeably. This is a use that should also be listed for the district, and it may be allowed. It's discretionary, something that would be sent either to your planning commission, your zoning board, or your governing body for review. So you can say yes or no, you can place conditions on it. But again, it's not just, we like it or no, we don't. It should be listed in the ordinance, and you should also have some sort of criteria in the ordinance. And then lastly, anything that's either not listed or strictly prohibited within the ordinance is something that's not allowed. You can kind of see the green always allowed all the way to the red. Not allowed. And a lot of communities will organize their uses into a table. This is unfortunately a pretty rural example, so not super applicable to your community. But let's say some people are interested in beekeeping in the city. All right, well, maybe you have some residential districts where that might be allowed. Maybe in most cases it would be conditional use. but it's something that would not be allowed in a commercial district. Same thing for a little farmer's lounge or a farmer's market, as I heard you guys talking about. Maybe that would be a conditional use in a commercial area, but not allowed in residential districts. So I do want to ask a little bit about conditional uses in your zoning code, because I did take a peek through it, and it didn't seem like you had a whole lot of them, so I'm happy to answer questions a little bit later on conditional uses. But I did want to review that here. Again, as I said, most districts will have conditional uses listed. It's specific to the district, and again, it's a discretionary decision. And then you do have the opportunity to attach conditions. And I'll talk a little bit more at the end about whether it's conditional use, a planned unit development district, or any other sort of discretionary approval. If there's a certain type of development approval that you're seeing a lot within your village, you may want to consider looking at, well, what do we frequently request of the developer, and actually make that part of your code. So each district lists those permitted and conditional uses. One tool, in a sense, for flexibility is a rezone or a zoning amendment. Your zoning ordinance is not set in stone, so you have the ability to change it. So you can either make changes to the text or to the map. This is a legislative decision, which means it's adopted by the governing body with input from your planning commission, and you do have a lot of discretion when you make these decisions. These decisions need to be reasonable, constitutional, and consistent with the comprehensive plan. And that last part is somewhat of a recent addition to Wisconsin. Another option I should have mentioned as well, what many of you are probably familiar with, just within the basic zoning code, and this is one of those things that was in zoning codes from the start, is a variance option. So if there's something you want to do with your property, that's not allowed, you could apply for a variance. If you meet certain conditions, which have actually been spelled out in state statutes through case law over the years, you might be allowed to vary from your zoning code, whether that's the use or dimensional variance, for example, a relaxed setback. All right, so now we're starting to get into a lot of these different tools that people have included in their zoning ordinances over time. One of them is performance standards. So, a traditional standard in an ordinance might look something like the one you want. Impervious surface coverage is limited to 25% of the lot to limit runoff. So what do you get? They follow that exactly. 75% of the lot might be maintained in green space, but as you can see in this photo, there's curbs, so anything that rains directly on there might be infiltrated, but the vast majority of runoff from the road may not actually make it into the green space. Versus the performance standard would specify the desired outcome. All stormwater runoff shall be retained on site. Treatments may include swales, filter strips, ponds, etc. So you could provide some different options, but the goal here is stated that you are retaining that stormwater on site. So in this situation, again, maybe you have the same amount or even less amount of green space, but you can see that there's no curb. Maybe the parking lot is draining to, you know, a little swale of some sort so that it can infiltrate. So you can get very different results just by how you're wording your standards and your ordinance. I think performance standards, you'll see them in many zoning codes. They are probably most effective with environmental regulations. Planned unit development is another tool that communities have evolved over time to include. I think you guys call it planned development districts, so PDD. PUD, PDD, same thing. So this is essentially where development is proposed or approved as a package. So it's particularly effective for mixed-use development. And the goal of this is to provide some flexibility in your zoning ordinance. So how much you specify in your zoning code in terms of what is allowed is really up to the local community. Some communities will put pretty tight parameters on them. Others will be fairly open. There should always be a process in terms of meeting with the developer, coming with the preliminary development plan. There's going to be a formal approval stage, and so forth. How you use this is really up to the local community. It could be granted as a conditional use, or it could be some sort of special rezone or like a floating district, an overlay district. So it could be, I think this is going to address your question here, it could be something where you're required to follow the underlying zoning district, or it could just be a simple rezone. In which case, like I stated earlier, you do have a lot of discretion in terms of what's allowed, in terms of uses, standards, etc. So I'm not an expert on your zoning code and how, Jeff, it's a rezone in your community, right?
It's like an overlay.
An overlay, okay. So yeah, it's really up to your locally adopted ordinance how exactly this functions. As you look to update your ordinance, you may say, okay, well, we've had, you know, half a dozen plan development districts. We think it's working well, or we're seeing we're having these challenges, or we're seeing we're constantly requiring these sorts of conditions of the developer. So perhaps we want to make that part of our zoning goal, so it's more spelled out to all the parties involved. Those are some things you can consider. Overlay zones. This is simply where you have your base zoning district, maybe residential, commercial, etc., and then you can have some special regulations that apply on top, like a shoreline overlay or a wellhead protection, historic district, etc. And then design reviews. This is a tool that a lot of communities, and actually I'd say this is probably the least frequently used of the things I've mentioned so far, where communities are regulating the aesthetics, the physical design of their communities. A lot of times this is applied in like a downtown area or a historic district. Could be part of your zoning ordinance, subdivision regulations, excuse me, or even standalone ordinance. Now, did you guys have maybe some sort of site plan review? Was it tied into design review as well?
There is some.
Yeah. And that's pretty recent? Alright. So this takes us now to form-based codes. As you can see, over time, communities have evolved a lot of different tools to make zoning work for their communities. They try to introduce flexibility, and a form-based code is really just one more evolution of the zoning code. The focus here is a lot less on what uses are allowed in the district versus what's the form and function of a particular area. So they'll prescribe the physical outcomes of an area. So what does the public space, what does the streetscape look like? What is the form of the building? And again, a lot of communities make hybrid use of these types of codes. So they might still talk about uses. And I think if you adapted it, you'd probably talk about uses. But there's less emphasis on use. It's more about how it looks and how it functions in terms of a public space. And that there's one thing that I think a lot of people gravitate to, there's a strong use of visuals in form-based codes. So even if you want to adopt form-based codes, you can learn a lot from looking at the visuals that they employ. So let me just compare and contrast. What are the main organizing elements in a traditional Euclidean zoning ordinance? You can have your zoning map, and then also your district regulations. So the text would describe what are the uses, and what are the dimensional standards, height of buildings, setbacks, and so forth. In a form-based zoning code, you may have a zoning map, or some communities call this a regulating plan. And some make use of both, and I'll talk about that in just a bit. Then they're also going to have a set of public standards. So this would talk about things that you see in the public realm. So sidewalks, street furniture, bike and travel lanes, parking, etc. And then there also is an emphasis on building standards. So maybe a build-to line, rather than having setbacks, we want you to build to this area. Remember, this a lot of this evolved from kind of that traditional neighborhood development, where you're seeing a return to maybe the traditional downtown patterns or even neighborhood residential patterns. And so we'll talk about what the buildings should look like, and then use is secondary to that. A lot of these optional elements you'll find, again, both in traditional codes as well as form-based codes. I'd say the ones on the right are definitely more common. Environmental, standards, signage, parking, etc. I'd say fewer communities have kind of those architectural or design standards or landscaping standards. But again, you can see them both. And then the administrative portions. They both have an administrative section. They're both going to have definitions. I'd say the illustrations is where you're going to see a big difference again. form-based codes have a lot of illustrations. They can be very descriptive through those illustrations. Traditional zoning codes, we're getting there. But I'd say that's one of the weaknesses of traditional zoning codes. But I think that's something you guys may want to think about as well. I didn't look at your zoning code, and I don't know if there's any images. All right, so let me take you through some of those different things. I feel like I'm kind of blocking here. Okay. All right, so one of the kind of organizing principle for form-based codes is what's known as the transom. And this is simply a recognition that a lot of communities are organized along, and think broader than your village here. So there may be natural areas, there may be some rural areas, suburban, maybe a bit higher density urban, maybe some urban centers, and then there are most urban areas, things like the city of Milwaukee, the core of that city. You guys maybe fall more kind of in this area. And that's okay. They recognize you would calibrate the code to your community based upon what different types of development you have. And then a lot of times you'd also see for a suburban area, maybe you'd have one or two or three different zoning districts that would go along with that. All right, so this is an example. I think I pulled this from the College Hill neighborhood in Cincinnati. Not as kind of an example. But I liked it because they had a lot of good graphics. And this was a hybrid code, which is something I think works quite well for a lot of communities. So what they did is they actually kept their traditional zoning districts, and they have more than you. It's definitely more complicated than your zoning ordinance. And then within some established neighborhoods, this is just for one neighborhood, they decide, you can see there's the transit free, suburban, urban center. And they had a couple different districts for that. And this was optional. They said for each neighborhood, you could propose a regulating plan for the city, and then the city could then adopt it. In this particular neighborhood, this was a very traditional, kind of like a main street area. And so they had proposed a few different form-based districts just around that traditional center. So look at it. So basically three different transect districts that they proposed. One was kind of this state district, which you can think of as kind of lower density residential. And then they talked about what's the desired form. So detached, single family homes, wide lots, fairly large setback, and so forth. They had a neighborhood, kind of medium density, where a little bit more dense development, maybe the buildings would be closer together, if not attached, closer to the street, and so forth. And then they also had kind of their main street district. Then for each of those districts, they would just prescribe the desired building type. And there are a lot of photos that illustrate this. So detached house, carriage house is like a garage structure that would also be allowed as an accessory structure within that and so forth. Building standards. Again, you also have this in your zoning code. But what they did here is they made it a lot more graphic, a lot more understandable, maybe a bit more prescriptive in terms of the physical form. So things like height of the building, setbacks, etc. Lot coverage, how much green space can we have? This code also does prescribe uses for each district. So this is for the estate district. So dwellings, home occupations, home offices, daycares. Oh, and actually what they have over here, P stands for permitted. UP, I think, is for conditional uses. So much like your ordinance, maybe adult daycare homes, some others, community facilities, those types of things would need a little bit of extra review at the planning commission. Then they also included these street and public space standards. So again, what is the desired width of roads? How much sidewalk we have? There's some planting requirements, street tree and street furniture requirements depending on the district. And of course, also like your code, they have parking, signage, and other standards. Okay. So not extremely different. I think the two main things that you're going to see different is that focus on the public forum, public space in the building. Overuse kind of becomes secondary to that. And then also I think they're really great at conveying information visually. It makes it a lot easier to understand. What we're seeing in a lot of communities, very few communities adopt form-based codes, and that's all they have. A lot of communities, existing communities anyways, are incorporating form-based elements into their code, whether that's using more visuals, whether that's adopting a form-based district or a few different districts that might apply to a traditional downtown, a traditional neighborhood, etc. Most communities are adopting a hybrid code. So I talked about all the evolution of zoning. We have performance standards, we have planned unit development, we have, you know, form-based codes and districts. What a lot of communities are doing is they're pulling in elements that work for their community. So use that as a reference. All right, so my suggestion then, if you're looking at your zoning code, recognizing maybe some weaknesses, recognizing some things you want to change, how do you move forward? I suggest not just focusing strictly on your zoning code. I suggest backing up, taking a look at some of your existing planning documents, whether it's your comprehensive plan or maybe some more recent or smaller scale planning documents that you've created. Taking a look at your development history. And I've already gotten some of that information from you guys. And then taking a look at your zoning code. Let's take a look here. So planning should be setting kind of that big future vision. Your zoning ordinance should be based on that vision, should be helping to implement that vision. The plan is future-oriented and guiding you 20, 30 years into the future. The ordinance is implementing what you have there today. It doesn't mean it needs to be completely reactionary. It should also be proactive in some sense, trying to help guide you towards that desired future vision and the type of development you want. Okay, so one thing you could possibly do is start to dig into your plan. All right, well, we said we want to encourage higher density near our downtown, lower density farther out, and then look at your code. Does it do that? If not, let's make note of it, and that's something we'll need to address. Again, this is just an example. This is from the city of Washburn, and before they updated their zoning code, they went through and they looked at their plan, they looked at their development trends, they looked at their zoning code, and so I'm going to pull some examples from that. So again, in their case, they hadn't addressed mixed-use neighborhoods or utilities and community facilities and how to use that to direct growth. So they made a note of that and said, we want to address that as we update our code. Another tool within your comp plan that can be really powerful is your future land use map. Some communities have a map that looks almost identical to their zoning ordinance, and that's okay. Others are a bit more broad brush, more future-oriented. And I think this is a really great example of that. This is from the village of Hortonville. And rather than delineating parcel by parcel, this is what we want to see. What they did is they identified some major corridors. Right. So this is an area where they're expecting a new roundabout. And then they know that this is going to be the main entrance to their community, as is this area. And they said, we want those to be future gateway improvement districts. So maybe we're going to promote this type of development. Within the plan, they would describe that. Then they have some areas which are, you know, priority mixed-use development, maybe some priority residential development, and they look broadly across the community to identify those areas. Right. So second, let's take a look at development trends that have been happening in the community. Again, this is from the city of Washburn, and they simply looked at, okay, how many appeals, conditional uses, variances, etc. And in their analysis, they said, we've had a lot of text amendments. That tells us our zoning code is maybe not working as well as it could. They also looked at their conditional uses. They thought they had a fair number. And so they said, okay, this is why we're approving them. And then after that, they could go back and say, are there changes we want to make to address this? Maybe if there's certain conditions we're constantly putting on them, we want to just make that part of our code. Or, you know, are the current zoning districts adequate? Is there something else we need to tweak? So, you were kind enough to send me your development patterns in the last number of years. I'm seeing a lot of text amendments, a lot of rezonings, a number of planned development districts. Now, I wasn't sure if you have not had any conditional uses or if you just simply haven't sent that, do you know?
Not that.
Okay. So, and that's...
I've only been here since 13.
And I'm not saying that it's not wrong not to have conditional uses. It's just a different pattern than what I see in a lot of communities. So I think I'm seeing in your development patterns, I'm seeing a lot more amendments to the zoning ordinance through both text and map amendments, and maybe more planned development districts versus a lot of communities. I probably see a lot more conditional use requests, a lot more variances. I don't know if you've put that on here. Sometimes variances can be a kind of a red flag as well if you're getting the same types of variances frequently. So what I suggest doing is taking a look at some of the actual development you've gotten. If I grabbed the Google image correctly, it looked like a number of more commercial, maybe mixed use, maybe even a little bit of residential development that you've been getting from your planned development districts. So take a look at the kind of development you're getting. Is it what your village was envisioning? Are there certain conditions you keep placing on them? And use that to inform if you're going to make any changes to your plan. And then, once you've done some of those things, then I suggest digging into the zoning code. Look at the major types of decisions that are allowed or provided for within your code. So maybe a simple permitted use, conditional uses, planned development districts, etc. And say, okay, where is that found in our ordinance? Is it clear? What do we want to change? And you kind of just go through kind of a triage approach. What's working, what's not, what can we... So, one suggestion that I kind of got the feel you're looking to reduce perhaps the number of zoning code amendments and or discretionary approvals of these planned development districts. A couple of tips you can do would be to include more guidance for rezones. This could either be within your comprehensive plan, within the zoning ordinance itself, or somehow interspersed throughout both of those. And I'll give you some examples of that. Take a second look at, for each district, what your permitted, conditional, and prohibited uses are. I think you could probably get a lot more mileage on conditional uses. Again, that's a discretionary review, but it's where you're laying out, these are the things, the types of uses you want to have, and then these are some conditions and review criteria that we're going to place on them. It makes it a lot easier if a lot of that is in your code up front. Again, whether it comes from conditional uses, from variances, planned development districts, if there's certain things you're always asking for, stick them in your code. It's a lot easier. And then it seemed like you may want more of a possibly a mixed-use district, perhaps even a form-based district as well. So it's something you might want to examine as well. So when I took a peek at your comp plan, I didn't study everything in detail. What it looked like at the end, you had tacked on a more recent corridor study. And so if you're thinking about some mixed-use areas, it sounds like you've already got a good start on some of that. Likewise, you had done a visual preference survey. If you were to go with the form-based district, one or more, that would provide some good background information to consider as well. Then I made that recommendation. How do you use your plan as well as your zoning ordinance to help you make decisions on rezones and on zoning text amendments as well? You did have some information in your comprehensive plan that you called plan amendment criteria, and I thought this was actually a really good summary of the plan. So you can take a peek at this as you're reviewing changes. In some ways this can guide you, but I thought a lot of these were actually more visionary, more kind of a summary of what you wanted, and that's a great start. But let me give you some more specific examples. So when people are considering a specific rezoning, so let's say this is the future land use category of low-density residential in a zoning code. Within the text of their comprehensive plan, they said, there's some zoning districts that are completely compatible. You know it's okay to rezone. There's some that might be compatible if certain conditions are present, and then there's some that just simply aren't compatible. And so they actually provide this type of guidance in the plan. So with that low-density residential, on your future land use map of your comp plan, maybe there'd be a corresponding zoning category, low-density residential. Then there might be a medium-density residential that could be appropriate if immediately adjacent areas planned and zoned for that, as well as served by public sewer and water. this is actually not a great example, more rural again. Perhaps a natural area. Also, if immediately adjacent areas planned and zoned for natural areas, and maybe not supply public sewer and water. And then there's, you're going to list some incompatible zoning districts. If on our future land use map it says low density residential, well, we know we don't want this high density multifamily, commercial, industrial, etc. Another trick, which I've only seen this a few times, but what some communities are doing, they're putting annotations either right on the future land use map or in the text of their ordinance for specific development areas. So here they're saying this is appropriate for future residential development, but first we need a new north-south collector road, which could provide the appropriate roads to service this development. So as you're going, if you're looking at a rezoning, you can say, do we have that in place? Is it something that's in our capital improvement plan? Is it something that maybe the developer is even able to, you know, contribute to? Those are the types of questions to ask. I'm not going to be through these as well, but some communities are actually putting rezoning considerations or criteria directly in their comp plan or even in their zoning ordinance itself, just to provide a little bit more guidance. Another thing I suggest doing is just once you get to that fine-grained detail, there's probably areas, whether it's you're told by a variance request constantly, or if staff has, I've seen a lot of zoning codes, there's sticky notes saying, okay, this is how we handled this, you know, 10 years ago, this is what it means. there's always bits of text that are confusing. So go in, this is just one I pulled, maybe, it took me a couple reads to figure out what this meant, but there's things that you guys probably stumble upon all the time, and that's normal. And then think about how can we either change the text, or is there some way that we can convey this either through a table, some graphics, photos, etc. A couple areas where I saw in your quote that you could easily make more graphic would be your parking standards, as well as your sign regulations. This was, I think, from the same form-based code. So you can see they had their transect districts where these types of signs would be allowed, some ground signs, monument signs, sandwich boards, etc. It's appropriate for some districts, not appropriate for others. And then it references where in the code they describe the specific standards. And then there's a whole page devoted to each of those specific types. They describe what the purpose is, what the legible or what the allowable sign area is, where it can be placed, etc. One thing I'd also suggest taking a look at in your zoning ordinance is reviewing to make sure your signs are content neutral. There's a fairly recent Supreme Court case, Reed versus Gilbert. And so if you're regulating, let's say you're regulating yard signs, and you're distinguishing between political signs versus church picnic signs versus some other examples, yard sale signs, some of those things are things you can no longer do. So you just need to make sure that you're regulating the same type of signs similarly. You're not distinguishing based upon the type of text or the type of speech that you've had. So I think that's what I pulled for now. I did have a few more slides where I just kind of wrote down my first impressions of the zoning code, so I'll pass it on to you. I'm going to tell you it's not a quick discussion to review your code, to update it. It sounds like you've done a number of updates over the years. But it may be time to take a step back and look at, you know, what are some of these bigger issues and is your code addressing the needs. And just like you guys have all probably gone through a comprehensive planning process, updating a zoning ordinance it's going to take some time and it's going to take some resources as well. So I'm happy to take any specific questions you guys have, or otherwise, I'm happy to serve as a reference if you guys have a question at this meeting and, you know, send it by email or phone.
Does anybody have anything for Becky?
Is there any overlap between fire requirements and building code that we should be considering?
Fire requirements?
Yes,
like the fire numbers? Or
what the requirements of the local fire departments, for instance, their capabilities to fight fires and multi-story buildings or things like that.
Okay, yeah, so. I mean, certainly I hope you consider that in a planning process in terms of the capacity and area served. Is that what you both spoke at the same time? Is that what you had said?
I said turning radiuses.
Turning radius. Like, oh, absolutely, absolutely. And those are things that you can address. I don't know if you have much in terms of that is something that a lot of form-based codes will address. It can be found in traditional zoning codes as well. But a lot of ingress, egress, you know, do we want to have cul-de-sacs? What's the turning radius? Absolutely. Those are things that you can address, and I recommend you do address in your code if you don't already have it. If you're talking building codes often operate completely separate from zoning. They're complementary, and so you need approvals for both. I don't know what you guys have for your building code, but there's also state standards, which is probably exactly what you're following.
When you see communities that have a lot of potential for infill-type development, are you seeing those communities move more towards a hybrid ordinance between form-based for those areas of infill? Or
yeah,
are you seeing them?
Fitchburg is the only community I'm aware of that has fully jumped into a form-based code. I shouldn't say fully. They've only implemented it in a... I think in a greenfield area, so an area that's not built. Okay. And then I think they have more for like an infill type development, maybe in a traditional downtown or a few designated areas. Not a lot of communities have actually jumped into form-based codes yet. I think there's a lot that are, I shouldn't say a lot, there's a number, a handful that are considering them, and then they're borrowing some elements from them. But again, that's kind of how zoning's evolved over time, is that, oh, yeah, I like this element of this new tool. How can we make it work for us? So.
Well, part of the issue with a form-based code, if you're going to have graphics, you're going to need to find someone who can mm-hmm. produce the graphics.
Mm-hmm. So one code I mentioned was called that smart code, and that's mm-hmm. completely open source. So it's something you can freely take and modify for your own. So you can grab some images from there, some graphics, and modify them for your own use. What most communities will do is work with a consultant who's able to take them not only through the process, but then can also help with that graphic work. So, if you have extra time, not volunteering you guys, if you're doing some significant updates to your code, it's going to take some time and some resources. There certainly are examples of communities where they've done it real low cost just by taking existing graphics, taking some existing text, tweaking it. I don't think you're going to want to take anyone else's example wholesale because it's not for your community. But it can be done. It can be done where you're modifying it and making it work.
I think the general criticism of our current zoning codes is it kind of fixes us in mid-20th century development patterns,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and we'd like to be able to permit redevelopment that can allow the city to progress, mm-hmm. or the village to progress and prosper, and have a better relationship to our neighboring communities.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and did you address some of your kind of neighboring issues with when you had done any of your planning processes, talking with your neighbors?
Our comp plan.
What are some of our main gateways? How do we intercept as communities?
Yeah,
there, that would be something you want
there
to
is information about that in our comprehensive plan. So.
Yeah, and so I suggest. Obviously, you've spent some time planning. I don't know how long since you've taken kind of a comprehensive look at your zoning ordinance. My honest impression, as I started looking at it, it looked very traditional. You had a very manageable number of zoning districts. I'm impressed with that. It was easy to follow early on. And then as I got through it, okay, it's all text. That's okay. But that's one area that you could possibly improve in. It looked like there were a lot of changes over time addressing very specific development issues that may have been requested. One of some things I thought of, I'm like, okay, I can see that with that because you have a lot of detail on this issue and a lot of detail on this issue. I think tree houses and brew pubs and
yes, those are current.
Parlors and am I naming all the things you guys So it was real obvious to me what you guys have addressed, but you may want to go back and kind of comprehensively take a look at some things.
I think one of the other things with our comprehensive plan, our zoning prohibits us from accomplishing what we want to accomplish with our mm-hmm. plan. And we've looked at that, but not in detail. So.
Okay. Yeah. So now might be the time.
No, that's what we're thinking.
I have a question, Becky.
Yeah.
What's kind of the back end for traditional versus form-based, or somewhere in between as far as like staff time or review time for Penn Commission? You see one that the kind of developers kind of gravitate towards because it's easier to work through, it's more transparent.
For the review process?
Yes.
So you're saying, let's say we went to a form-based code or we had some form-based districts, is that going to make your life easier? Depends on how you craft it. I think there's a number of tools you could use. You know, looking at conditional uses, I think you can make better use of those. You might want to consider some sort of mixed use, maybe some sort of form-based district in some targeted areas. I think just looking at the type of development you've had and saying, okay, here's what we got, here's what we regulated, and, you know, here are the criteria that worked well. Can we incorporate those in our code? You know, how could you, there's a lot of tools you can use to introduce flexibility. It's a matter of just going back and making it work for you. I can't say that it's going to make your life easier if it's not well done. You can make changes and changes and changes, and if it doesn't truly get at what you're looking for, it's not going to help you. So be strategic about those updates that you make.
It's one type of code more versatile in like in new buildings versus a village where you have to fill in. If you're starting to plan a new area,
uh-huh.
Would one type of code work better in that versus what we're dealing with here?
I would say that a lot of form-based codes were developed for kind of these master plan communities, kind of the, I don't know if you've ever heard of Celebration Florida, where it's a completely new community. They've also used it quite frequently in kind of infill situations where maybe they have a traditional downtown or a traditional residential neighborhood, and they want to continue that pattern of development.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be for that area or maybe an adjoining area. I think those are some areas that are really successful where form-based codes have been used. To be quite honest, there's not a whole lot of communities in Wisconsin, maybe even in nearby areas, that have used it. It's one of those newer and evolving tools. So I guess what will be,
Form-based codes have been around for about 20 years now. So
yes, yeah, but not a lot. I don't think there's, they have been, but there's not a lot of examples of them in our area.
Well, not in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
I think that's particular to the various political characteristics.
Yeah, I mean, there certainly are many people who are absolutely in love with them, and they do have their strengths, certainly. I think even if you don't go with a form-based code, there's a lot to learn from them. So maybe just taking a peek at some other zoning codes may be a good starting point to kind of give you some inspiration about. You've probably looked at your code how many times. You probably know some of those areas that you struggle with. Start to make note of those, and then take a peek at some other examples.
Part of our problem is that if you really look at our zoning map, you'll see all kinds of spot zoning. You know, one parcel is industrial, next parcel is commercial, then another industrial one. Then some residential ones all lined up together, and it just makes no sense. It's obviously good old boy planning.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd like to figure out how to find ways of correcting.
As I saw kind of in those recent development trends, is a lot of rezones, both map and text amendments. Maybe you want to examine what are your criteria, when do you allow those? Is our plan strong enough to inform that? Even though a zoning amendment is legislative, meaning you do have that wide discretion. Is it in line with your comprehensive plan? Is it in line with the future vision that you want? And you guys need to hold yourselves more accountable to make sure that's happening.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about the incompatible uses. And these, one that you particularly picked up was the large R1 zoning versus the multifamily. And that's what we're having a problem with right now, just on the Marcos Street property. So how do we address that so that every time somebody decides that they just want to knock down a house on a big lot, that and not trying to drag in the neighborhood and have everybody come in and say that they don't want an apartment complex on there. So my thoughts are, is that if you're going to be allowing somebody to do a PDD and multifamily, there should be some underlying criteria in order to do that. You just can't knock down a house and say, I want to put on an apartment complex, and then everybody gets upset, and then you have to have four meetings, and then it's hard to get the whole neighborhood to attend four meetings. So, you know, that's what I would like to see, is have a criteria for if you're going to change the underlying zoning from nice big houses to duplexes and apartments, there should be some sort of underlying zoning that's going to be put in place. So a zoning change is going to have to happen before the PDD is approved. So I'd like to see the underlying zoning compatible with the PDD.
So the one example I gave where it said that low-density residential versus multifamily was incompatible, that was their view. Not all communities would say that.
I just
want to make that point first.
I saw it. That's the example I want to use.
Where was I going with this? but I think you're correct that any type of development approval, the more standards you can put in your plan, whenever you add flexibility, you also want to add some criteria for yourself so that it's not just a free-for-all. It's going to actually make your life easier. If you, like I said, if there's those recurring things that you're requirements that you're putting in all developments, make that part of your code or make that conditions that you automatically attach. Zoning and land use issues are not easy. And so, you know, you do need to have important community conversations. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that you have four meetings to discuss this. Maybe you should be doing that before you get specific rezoning proposals. I think as a fairly built-up community, you're going to have a lot of opportunities for infill, for change over time, and seeing the facility right across the street, more elderly housing. I guarantee you in the next 5-10 years, you're going to get many more proposals like that. So you need to have those important conversations, saying where is it appropriate, under what circumstances. If it is next to a residential area, what considerations do we need to think about in terms of parking, lighting at night, ingress, egress? You know, do we need some landscaping to separate that from a different type of use? Or is that just, you know, maybe that's a completely appropriate for a residential area? Those are the conversations you need to have.
Do we need to announce anything if we want to ask questions?
We should. Actually, we should suspend the rules and then... And I'm fine with doing that, if you think Christian is.
Move to suspend.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, now you can come up to the... Please come up to the podium. Sorry, I didn't make Jim do it.
That's okay. I just didn't want to... I know I missed the first 25 minutes. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Not a big deal.
I don't know that I need to say much. Matt Gelb, 2539 Martha Avenue. So we have... There's some specific PDD questions that we've kind of as a smaller neighborhood within the village just kind of asked questions, but I was intrigued by one of the first things that I heard as I walked in, if it's a close quote, that you saw many more PDDs here than you typically see. Did I hear that?
Well, I mean, 6 isn't a huge number, but I saw a lot of rezones, a lot of text amendments, and I saw virtually no conditional uses, and so I wasn't sure if that was just missing. So compared to that, I would expect to see more conditional uses in those communities.
Yeah, and when you started to talk
zoning changes.
Oh, yeah, if the baseline, if the whole base changes, you mean? When you say zoning changes? Or
yeah, either a rezone from one district to another and just kind of tweaking the text of the zoning ordinance.
And I just picked up on something when you're kind of using the example over here when you talk about you need to put in X amount of landscaping. Do you typically see zoning codes get into absolute sizes? I know we talked about a little bit of the restriction on some of the odd size lots that you have in parcels and kind of mins, maxes. I know there's a little bit in what I have memorized in our code, per se. But it seems like, you know, I guess is it doesn't get super heavy and stuff like that.
It's really a matter of where you want to go with that.
Okay. And then just one other thing that you talked about, let me just see if I can't catch it. There was kind of a state standards. So from a state standard perspective, when we look at Wisconsin, are there... State standards around PDDs that
that's one of those tools, much like conditional uses, even though that wasn't that Standard Zoning Enabling Act, which is a nationwide thing. It was actually called special exceptions way back when, and it's only that term was only mentioned once, like for your city enabling statutes. Planned development districts may or may not be mentioned, but they're tools that have evolved with zoning over time, so there are no state standards. It's how you use it. You can choose to do it as a rezoning, as a conditional use. You have a lot of flexibility there.
Well, the PDD process is an element of state statute for planning. Comprehensive planning, isn't it?
There was a requirement that villages and cities over 12,500 or something adopt a traditional neighborhood development. That's different. Is that what you're referring
to?
No,
I thought...
I'm not aware.
Yeah. I'd have to look at the law again, but I thought there was something that enabled PDD processes in
communities. I think there's some good practices in terms of the process that you go through. But unlike a variance, which has been heavily contested in courts over the years, those criteria have been placed essentially into state standards because of court cases that have set the rules over time. That's not the case for conditional uses, a little bit for conditional uses, but less so for planned development districts. I'd say it's not used as frequently as some of those other tools.
Can you give us some examples of conditional use and where we would use them? Because evidently we don't use it a lot. I think the Quick Trip, the place where the Quick Trip was, wasn't a conditional use situation. Am I correct?
No.
That's correct. Yep.
Okay.
Wasn't that already?
I saw it in a commercial district or something like that.
Yeah, but it was in a residential district.
Permitted uses would be single family, maybe, you know, two family would be permitted. It's all up to your community. But maybe anything above two families. So multifamily, maybe a bed and breakfast, maybe certain types of home-based businesses or offices. I don't know, maybe a church in a residential district. So things that... they're generally compatible. Most people wouldn't be too opposed with something that, you know, maybe they're going to generate more traffic, more visitations, more, you know, more whatever than a typical residential thing. So it's so all over the place. I can give you plenty of examples. If you're looking, let's say you have issues like, you know, corners, gas stations or grocery stores, and you want some examples of language, and you have to pull that. But those are some examples where you may not want to just allow certain things outright, but you say, well, that's appropriate for a commercial district, but we want to be able to place conditions on it. We want to make sure that the lighting is appropriate, that the hours of operation are appropriate. So you can really do this with anything.
So you're breaking a big rule and making some little rules inside of it?
Exactly, yeah.
That one place down on Webster, or on Libel, right before you turn by the Y, she had a little business in her house. I think that was another place. It's not there anymore.
Did you see, just from your experience, so again, we'll talk about the Village of Alloway with a lot of infill development opportunity. Mm-hmm. And when you see a lot of PDDs that are not greenfield, what is that an indicator of in your mind?
that's a tool that provides flexibility in your ordinance. I don't know the specifics of what's been proposed.
Some of our concerns have been around, is the zoning ordinance the way it currently is? Is it making it difficult for us to infill based on our zoning code versus going to the PDD? So I was just curious to know.
I'm guessing if you have, especially in a lot of your commercial and higher intensity districts, if you have mostly all just permitted uses, and then, by the way, I think you also had 91 prohibited uses. Get rid of it. You had you call them abattoirs or something, slaughterhouses. You had all sorts of things that are taking space, whereas a traditional zoning code, if you have those permitted uses and conditional uses, and if there's something you want to say is definitely prohibited, you can do that. But by exclusion, if you don't mention it, it's excluded. So that's one little change you can make. But I think for you guys, if you just want to work with your existing code, having a set of conditional uses, maybe starting in some of your more commercial areas, if that's where you're seeing some of those desired info, or maybe even some new residential areas, and saying, okay, well, how did you guys allow this, was it a senior?
CBRF.
Okay, CBRF. How did you guys allow this?
PDD.
It was a PDD.
PDD. So that's a valid approach. Nothing wrong with that. Where I'm seeing most planned unit development, it's with much larger parcels, usually with a mix of uses, where you're going to want to allow that kind of. It's really just a big variation from your zoning code. Not that your plan or that your zoning ordinance wouldn't provide some direction in terms of what type of development you want, but it's really where you're planning it and approving it as a package. And so you are able to provide that added flexibility. Usually with just one single use, you could allow that through a conditional use, where you say, okay, these are our review criteria, recognizing it's something you could allow or that you could turn down if they don't fit appropriately for that site and if you can't attach conditions to make it more appropriate.
I guess that's one frustration I have, is that the PDDs that we've seen come through are pretty thin on the need for the PDD process.
Mm-hmm.
It's like all one use instead of mm-hmm. multiple uses.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fairly small parcel. It seems like it should have gone, before the Board of Appeals rather than come before mm-hmm. Plan Commission and PDD.
Yeah.
It's like PDD should allow for larger higher quality, better quality uses to the property,
mm-hmm.
and more potential for benefit to the community rather than something like that, which is kind of a dead facility. It doesn't add anything to the community other than some tax base. So.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't suggesting it was a dead facility.
But I'm
saying that it's easier to allow that through a conditional use rather than. I'm guessing your PDD process is maybe a little bit more involved than a conditional use process
mm-hmm.
would have to be.
Yeah.
So you can assign conditional uses in your ordinance to either the Plan Commission, your Zoning Board of Adjustment or Appeals, or to your governing body. One benefit to assigning it to the Plan Commission is that on appeal, you can keep it within your community because then it will go to your Board of Adjustment before it can then be appealed to Circuit Court. Otherwise, it will go to Circuit Court directly if it was decided by your elected officials or your zoning board.
Yeah. It's one of the things that you sometimes see and that can be a little disconcerting, and I think it's kind of around this example that was brought up tonight, is that when PDDs are done within communities that are going to be infill developed communities, they can sometimes be a surprise
mm-hmm.
to the residents
mm-hmm.
versus if the zoning code is updated to actually show what the comprehensive plan shows
yeah.
for that area,
mm-hmm.
then there's not a surprise.
Yeah. It may still be a surprise to most people, but you can look
but in 20 years, it won't be a surprise.
Say, hey, that's within the parameters of what we're looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah, most people are surprised by any land use issues.
Yeah.
Part of it is just a lot of public outreach, too, and having those conversations. If you do revisit your plan and your zoning ordinance, make sure that there's some close alignment there as well.
One of our biggest challenges is converting to mixed use from our commercial infill, our commercial sites, like on Webster Avenue, and particularly over by Zessie's, we're working on a project that we'd like to have a mixed use. What's the right way to introduce mixed use into our code if we don't have any such animal now?
The right way.
What's a good way?
Yeah. I would say take a peek at, if you want to diversify some of those conditional uses and or permitted uses. If you're trying to promote mixed use, consider how you can incorporate those through those permitted and conditional uses without having to do the PDD. I'd say the PDD is, the way most communities use it is for those much larger developments, maybe where they're assembling different pieces of land, that's not a requirement, and then they're, having quite a diversity of mixes that would just be real difficult to get individual approval for this use and that use. oftentimes in exchange, when you're doing that PDD, if you're allowing them that flexibility, you may have higher requirements than for landscaping and,
mm-hmm.
parking and all that sort of thing, too. But I think there's a lot of ways you can put those things into your code if there's areas where you do want mixed use.
Okay. We can return to regular session, so let's back to some questions if you guys are for that. I'll entertain a motion to return to regular session.
Mm-hmm.
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, we are back in regular session. So if anybody has any other questions for Becky or clarifications.
Well, thank you, guys. And if anything comes up, feel free to communicate to me directly or however you want to do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
All right, moving on to item number 8, action regarding recommendation for further investigation of zoning code project and budgeting of project costs. So Trevor put a memo in our packet. And what it's really coming down to, Trevor, and correct me if I'm wrong, is making a recommendation from this body to try to include some line item within the annual budget for engagement of a consultant, I assume.
Right. And I'll come up here because the microphone is dead, just so you can hear it to the minutes.
Yep.
As Becky indicated, this process is very complex, can be very time-consuming. And we definitely want to make sure we do it right, knowing that this is a 30-year investment. It's like building a road, in my opinion. But in many ways, probably way more complex than that. So I think a consultant, at least at some level, is most needed. And you're correct. I would like some indication if this is if you'd like me to make that budget request, I can certainly do so. And we can continue this discussion and see if we can do an RFQ and get into that. But I think before we get into all that, in the essence of time with budget, I would like the Plan Commission's opinion as far as if we should put this in budget or not, or at least a budget request.
What amount are you considering putting in for a budget request, Trevor?
I think it would be a 2-year project, as we've discussed before.
And divide it?
No, and then we would probably do a 2-year project. I know in the past they had given that $120,000, and that's just because that's what I've heard from some other communities. But asking around further, it's more at like what Wes indicated, probably the $60,000 to $80,000 is what you're looking at.
Well, and then would your approach be that staff would put together the RFQ, or did you hire a consultant to do the whole thing? Staff put together the RFQ and then engage the consultant, is that right?
Correct.
So that can take 6 to 7 months. By the time you get out through all the meetings and interviews with the consultant and choose a consultant and set a project budget. You don't need much money this fiscal year, I don't think, for the engagement part of it, but you certainly want to show good faith to the consultants when you're putting out the RFQs and you're asking them to come to meetings and things like that, that you are actually going to move forward with the projects. It doesn't hurt to have a line item. I don't think you need more than $10,000, and it can probably be less. You're not going to spend it all. So,
what did the corridor study cost?
60-ish. Yeah, 68 or something like that. Yeah.
I thought that went together fairly quickly as far as...
It was quick.
Putting out an RFP and...
I would put some information in, Trevor, of exactly that, like the total cost and then the increments we'd go in, so that when we're looking at the budget, everybody knows what we're... That there's a lot more to it than the first number. Show the numbers that are coming after.
Yeah, and the only reason why I say the $10,000 is because you might start it this fiscal year, towards the end of the fiscal year,
yeah,
and you might get an invoice.
I think there's a lot more reflection that has to be done as far as taking a look at our comprehensive plan a little bit more closer, past developments. I know we started that initially with some numbers, but diving into those, seeing why those went to those processes. Because I haven't only been here 3 years, and I think the numbers I threw at you were the past 10, so I'll have to do some research there too. But we need to do all that before we can
actually go out for an RFQ.
We want to know what we're asking for.
Yeah.
Why.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, is there something else that Plan Commission can do to help facilitate that?
Well, this is an action item. We're supposed to vote on something here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, with the research that needs to be done before we even get any further.
I think on your own, if you look into the different types of zoning codes a little further than what Becky, I mean, that is crash course.
Mm-hmm.
And but there's a lot of information out there at several different websites, and I can certainly share some of those with you. Some of them are kind of eye glazing. Others are pretty easy to follow. So
I'll take the easy ones.
You could also, the way that we're looking at it, you can frame it up that we are following the appropriate steps with the corridor study, looking at the comprehensive plan. The next step is, you can do all that, but if you don't do anything with your zoning ordinance,
you can't really do anything.
We did just have an update of our comprehensive plan within the last couple of years.
Right. So it seems like we've gotten to the point now.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. Do you want a dollar amount, or is that something that... I'm sorry, Rick.
I'm sorry. Is this still available, this 2010 study?
I've seen it before. I looked through my records. I do not have it. So if you're able to let me that, and I can make a copy.
Maybe, because almost everybody here is new and haven't seen this before, so maybe distributing it to everyone would help.
Roger, do you want to just share what you're... Just for the record.
This was a study conducted by a student group from UWGB in the public policy area. It was a planning theory and methods class that looked at our comprehensive plan and our zoning code and identified inconsistencies. So.
I know I had to put that cup. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find it.
Anyways, it would just be helpful to read through that, because that's kind of what set this off a number of years ago.
It's been a long time making it, from what I understand.
So, well, and there are other issues. I mean, we've already seen, for example, in two or three cases where property was purchased, plats were recombined, so a larger building could be built, or a person could expand their property into what was an adjacent property. And if economic development increases in the region, salaries rise, probably, and gas prices also rise, you'll probably find people coming in and trying to, Elmhurstize Alloway, which is basically buying up multiple small properties and building McMansions on the combination of those. So, how do we want to address that kind of redevelopment in the community? And then how do we also want to encourage higher quality commercial and workspace development? So.
Do you need a dollar amount from us, or just the saying yes? Put in. You guys can do it yourselves, right? You can decide that? Okay.
I think more or less looking for the support from the commission.
Okay. Is there it is an action item, so is there a motion?
So I will move that we recommend a budget item to engage a consultant to update our zoning code so it's consistent with our comprehensive plan.
There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Moving on to item number 9, update of bicycle and pedestrian plan. So I guess Roger or Trevor could probably give that update.
Sure.
We're at the point of having a final draft ready for public viewing. The document has been available for anyone to see, but we've gone through most of the text and many of the maps. We've identified areas in the village which could use additional treatments to improve bicycle and pedestrian access. The main goal is so that more people in the community are comfortable walking or bicycling to get around within the community and to adjacent communities. So we've gone through a number of recommendations on facilities, places where we'd like to see additional specific facilities to address different needs for walking and bicycling. So I think we have a schedule for implementing public meetings, which I think Trevor can give us. So I don't remember. The only thing is that the ad hoc committee is almost at a point of disbanding because of the current status of the development of the plan. It's far enough along that the committee will just allow it to go through the normal public approval process.
Yeah, the thought is hopefully within the next month or so. Tomorrow night we actually have a meeting. We'll be looking at the committee came up with the maps for pedestrian and bicycle facilities, and Public Works had to review those and try to mesh it with the street reconstruction plan. And so tomorrow night we'll have the committee reviewing these maps to kind of give a formal approval to the draft of these maps, just so that we can then take these maps to Plan Commission, Public Works, have you guys discuss them, give your input. Along with that, hopefully in the next month, as Roger indicated, we'll have the draft of the text pretty much finalized, where we want to bring it to the public as well. We'll have an open house, and we'll definitely have the Plan Commission, Parks and Rec, and Public Works review that plan as well. And at the end of all that, the committee will kind of meet one final time to kind of just take in the recommendations and see what they want to add to the add or removed or adjust, and adopt or recommend a final plan to then be forwarded to the village board. Hopefully we can get it all done this year. That's my goal.
Great. Any comments for Trevor or Roger? All right. Looks good. Moving on to item number 10, discussion of annual site tour. I don't know if, Trevor, you had any updates from the site tour you wanted to mention? Or?
Well, I was just going to have Angie or Penny or Roger, whoever was there, if they want to just give their opinions on the discussion of this map of the places we visited.
One thing is, I think by moving the cars, we got around a lot faster and saw a lot more. So bike was fun, but we were more efficient. I also think it's very helpful doing that. I just stand around that trip and looking how it did turn out and what went right and what we didn't really think went so right. I just think it's very useful.
I it was helpful to see the sites, have a discussion, answer some questions. Yeah, good job.
I was a little bit disappointed about not being able to see the tank inside the water building.
Next time we'll just have to open the hatch.
With a flashlight. So,
actually, it was helpful to see that water building, because I think everybody had a particular, almost romantic understanding of what it might be, and it's much more nuts and bolts.
It's a little disappointing, that's true. The outside is sort of cute, though.
Okay, great. Sounds like it was successful. Moving on to item number 11, discussion protocol for developer presentation. Now, Trevor, I don't know if you got anything together. I think you mentioned to me that you had some rules that the Plan Commission had put together beforehand. I think, Roger, you had brought this item for discussion.
I guess, Roger, I would let you take it off. I do have the documents that we give developers that the Plan Commission approved a few years ago. It mirrors what is in our zoning code. I guess that's the process we follow. But
my main concern is that when our recommendation goes to Village Board, that in some way they're given a clear understanding of what the substance of our recommendation is. And if we've had significant discussion on particular issues, that that be objectively presented so that they're fully aware of what our concerns were and, you know, how we got to resolution in making the recommendation to either approve or deny or whatever. So it's really a case of, on several of occasions, I felt the need to, you know, stand up and clarify certain issues to the Village Board and make sure that they have a chance to ask questions of how I perceive the discussion to have gone. So,
are you taking additional information included in the packets?
Well, I'm not sure what the Village Board sees, but on one side of things, I think, you know, in the staff presentation, there should be, and for the public, especially when there's public attending, a clear description of what issues limit a type of development that wouldn't have to come before a Village Board. What's making the PDD necessary? You know, what are all those issues that make this public participation process necessary? And that should be a very objective presentation on the part of staff. And then the promotion and description and, you know, the promising of how they're going to meet all of the requirements that we're placing on the developer should be made by the developer, and they should have adequate materials. I've often complained in the past that a lot of the developer materials are really lacking in addressing neighborhood context, traffic. I've never seen a traffic study from a developer, and I think that's a problem. It's going to be more of a problem as if we get any intensive developments. So,
but isn't that a little out of place, Roger? Because when they're bringing it and asking, they don't know where it's going to go, and if it's going to go nowhere, they're not going to put a big investment in the traffic studies and things like that.
Well,
like certain things we've looked at, I mean, they're just a concept, it's just an idea, and for them to put a lot of money into it, and you're just going to say no, that seems kind of...
I think what needs to happen is what Becky kind of indicated is we need more
criteria
that gives the developer more confidence that the project is less subjective and more objective. Better indication of what the village wants, so having pictures or design criteria in place would be helpful too.
Yeah, like the one off Martha Street, once anybody looked at it, everybody was going, well, that doesn't fit there.
Right.
And if there was some underlying criteria, maybe not even got that far, so they wouldn't have wasted their time and more time with it.
Right, because as it stands now, staff is limited to giving the developer their opinion.
Right.
And it's pretty much that. I mean, they're still open to apply to the process,
yes.
No matter, you know, what kind of development it is.
Yeah, and if you had some standard criteria that you would go and you would say, well, this is never going to fly because you can't have enough green space, or it's too many people for, you know, the lot, or I don't know how you develop that criteria.
That's a good point, though, too. Like, just kind of historically with this village, is that the development that's going to be coming forward is going to be so much different than other communities that are developing greenfields. It's going to be a lot more complicated, and there's going to be a lot more neighborhood context type issues that come up. And I know you and I have had conversations before about, hey, what do you think about this or whatever else? And if there's no clear standard, and I'm a developer, I might not want to, you know, engage in the process, because no matter how much work you do, you're still working and spending money to
right.
try to present something.
Right.
It's still your opportunity cost, your time, or whatever else. So it just, I think, further exemplifies the need for us to make some changes on the zoning side, whether it be more conditional use language or make it more clearly understandable as to what we actually want. Because you can look at a comprehensive plan and see what's, okay, that's nice that they decided that's what they want the future to be, but if it's not written down in the zoning code.
Right, and that's something that could be included. For example, our commercial district is so, it's just that, it's one commercial district. A lot of other municipalities have tiered commercial districts. So you could have a very high traffic commercial business, or you have a low traffic commercial business, and you might have a low traffic commercial zoning, but with conditional use of a traffic impact study, and really it might allow a higher traffic business in that lower traffic commercial business. If that makes sense.
I followed that.
But right, the zoning code is just another tool that's going to help us facilitate development in the village.
Do you have any idea why we haven't used conditional use? I don't know. I mean, the only place I know is that Quick Trip.
Right now, the process
before it was the Quick Trip.
Right now, the process is identified in our zoning code, but it really doesn't tie it to any specific zoning district.
Okay.
So there's not clear standards put in place. It's really, in my opinion, subjective, because the process is there, but it doesn't give requirements for that process to be used. The only instance would be the group hub that I can think of offhand, and that's, it gives some architectural styles if you're going to have a commercial zoning.
That zoning?
Okay, wasn't sure if there'd be a desired outcome from this conversation, but
I think for now on, I'll try to be more inclusive as far as what I include in the package to the vote for, a little bit more neutral, is what I'm understanding, and we'll just proceed forward with the zoning district, or with the zoning update.
If I'm not mistaken, when it was presented to the village board, there was a list of what staff's recommendations were and concerns, and then there was a list of what plan commissions were. So I don't know what would have been left out.
I guess maybe I could bring gets to the attention of the board. Maybe it has more discussion items.
Mm-hmm.
Be sure they're discussed at least. I know the board reviews the packet, but that way the audience has a more understanding.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. And, you know, your jobs aren't to just put the packet together to make professional recommendations, so don't be nervous about making a recommendation for something that you feel fits with the zoning code and the integrity of the community and everything else. I don't think that's what we're asking. So when you said, I'll try to be more neutral, you're a professional.
Okay.
You know, yeah. Make a recommendation and everything else. Don't even be scared to do that. I've always been torn on this, but sometimes board meetings fall where maybe the plan commission meeting minutes haven't been approved yet. I don't have a problem with the village board having access to plan commission meeting minutes if we have not approved them yet. People on the board, maybe you do. I don't. I don't feel like we're doing anything that important or that crazy that we want to keep it a secret before they're approved. So that's something to consider if you're not doing that yet. If you're not including plan commission meeting minutes to the village board just because they haven't been approved by the plan commission yet, we can make that an action item at the next plan commission meeting if you want us to vote on it, and the plan commission can decide, but the more information, the better.
Typically, after a plan commission meeting and there's a recommendation, and we'll use a PDD or preliminary approval process, Trevor does spell out and try to highlight the plan commission's recommendation, even though that hasn't been approved, but this was a recommendation to try to help steer them into a clearer picture, but not always is it.
No, you can throw the minutes. No, minutes in there, maybe see some discussion points that the board would like to see, and they don't necessarily have to be in the packet for public consumption, but they can go to an email to the village board, I think. Again, I don't know if they have to be in the packet or not, but either way, I don't have a problem with if they are.
Yeah, they should be part of the packet.
Okay.
And then what they would be is unapproved minutes at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the recommendation.
But I tell you, the visit village board will say, you know, what was plan commission's recommendation. They wouldn't move ahead of something if they didn't have plan commission's recommendation first.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen that happen? Me neither.
Okay, so maybe I'll just throw that on the agenda for next time. Action of
sure.
Getting the...
Sure, if it requires an action.
Maybe if we're going to discuss that again, maybe include the checklists that we're supposed to go... The developer is supposed to meet for the PDD and site plan review that
sure.
We have previously approved. So,
I think as an action item, it certainly gives clear indication what it is or that you're looking for from us, from the staff. I think that would be mm-hmm. great to have. And from both sides, from the staff's perspective and from a plan commission member. You're expecting to see this, and we're expecting to provide this. So.
Anybody else? Okay. We can move on to item number 12, next meeting date and agenda items. I think we just have one agenda item we were going to add. Trevor and Brad, you got that, however you want to word it.
Mm-hmm.
Action for mutual accountability or something. I don't think I had anything else. Do you know of anything else coming before us? Is it too early to tell?
Will the bike ped plan draft be ready?
Yeah, I think we'll be able to at least start discussion on that.
Good. How about, I don't know how the timing works right now with the action we took tonight on the budgeting for the zoning code, but I think that's something we should keep on the agenda going forward, either updates on zoning code process or mm-hmm. whatever else, just to keep it in front of us.
Yeah,
I heard a rumor that one of the parcels we had dealt with in the past is being considered for that the Martha property is being reconsidered in some way. Is there?
I did receive something from the owner saying that she had interest. It sounded like it was single family, but it was just an email.
Oh, another thing that kind of popped into my head in the discussion of zoning code. I usually see when the Board of Appeals, is that what it is, Board of Appeals meets? Maybe we should get reports whenever they take action on an appeal so that we know if, I mean, that should enter into our knowledge as far as changes that are being made, because they affect setbacks and things like that. So.
Okay. I also pulled some numbers for Wes regarding the number of Board of Appeals over the last 10 years, so I can share that information with the Planning Commission as well, what types of appeals were granted.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay, so no big developments coming before us then or anything like that?
No, in case the Planning Commission did not catch word already, the Mayflower development, they received word from Chris Vino on behalf of Mayflower that they're no longer interested in purchasing the property at this time. So.
Okay. You know why? Yeah, all right. Okay, I don't think I have anything else for the agenda for next meeting unless somebody else does. Maybe there'll be more business to come before us, but everything, zoning code, bike ped plan. Okay, moving on to item number 13, adjournment. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
I'll move.
We have a motion.
Second.
And a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We are adjourned.